Okay, let's go ahead and get started for our continue our discussion from this morning. Let's now discuss the election to adopt U.S. GAAP or IFRS that's under consideration. Although the FASB and the International Accounting Standards Board are working towards convergence, differences still remain between their standards. The SEC noted these differences in the two SEC releases that we previously mentioned this morning. Different protocols exist for determining an appropriate answer when U.S. GAAP and IFRS standards do not cover a particular matter. This leads us to our next question, our question number four, which is, are there specific differences between U.S. GAAP and IFRS that are so significant that they pose unique challenges for U.S. auditors? Do any provisions of the International Financial Reporting Standards pose auditability concerns? Any comments? Cynthia Richardson?
As we talked about earlier, there are material differences between IFRS and U.S. GAAP. And I think the laundry list contained in the briefing paper is quite good as sort of an example that in some instances, IFRS doesn't even have comprehensive standards or any standards at all, as opposed to the comprehensive guidance on the U.S. GAAP side. So I think that would make auditing particularly difficult in those circumstances. Limited guidance on the extractive industries. And this one I found particularly troublesome, that there's no common format for the income statement, which I think is only going to add to investor confusion. No standards on mergers, recapitalizations, et cetera. So I think it poses a significant risk and a significant challenge for investors understanding the financial statements if this happens.
Joe Carcel.
Cindy beat me to the punch, but that was really exactly what I wanted to say, but I want to elaborate a little bit on it. One of the things that you don't have in the briefing paper is you really talk about differences in the guidance from international standards to U.S. standards, in my view, largely talking about level A GAAP. But what about level B, level C, and level D GAAP? That's a very significant body of literature. And if you look at level B GAAP, we're talking about extractive industries, Cindy, and insurance. There are industry accounting and auditing guides on airlines, on casinos, on broker-dealers, on and on and on and on and on. What happens to that? That goes away. What about ESOPs? ESOPs are a very significant form of financing. There's an SOP on ESOPs. That's the only guidance that I'm aware of on ESOPs. There's no analog to that in the international standards. So if a U.S. registrant adopted IFRS, because the SEC allowed that, how would the auditor handle, what would they rely on? I would assume they'd go back to U.S. GAAP because that's all that's there. But the company could argue, well, we don't have to follow that. The SEC's given us the option of using IFRS.
Bob Kippers.
You know, those points that Cindy and Joe made are they're valid, but I think that there's a much bigger issue. In terms of unique challenges for U.S. auditors, and I'll just take the conventional characterization that we have more of a rules-based set of standards and that IFRS is certainly closer to principles-based, although you could take some issue that it's truly achieved that. And it's the cultural difference of how you go about working with your client, how you go about being challenged by the regulators, the possibility of very similar facts coming up with two different answers and both being right. I mean, we have an entire one generation, maybe a little more, of people who were trained and their skills were based on essentially a lot of the rules and a lot of the levels of guidance we have today. If we're really going to transition, and just take it all the way, transition to a U.S. system where principles-based standards rule the creation of financial statements, I mean, that's a big, big change in terms of how we work with our client as an auditor, because it's going to be much more judgment-oriented, and and as awkward as it is today when clients say, you know, tell me where it says I can't do that, we're going to be in a much less definitive space when we say, well, I just disagree with you, my judgment versus yours. And if you disagree to the point where you're not willing to sign the opinion, then you've got a bit of a standoff. I just think that, you know, I think there's general support for more principles-based, but I also think that, you know, many are ill-prepared to live in that world. Not that it's bad, it's just different. But I think if, as an auditor, that's going to significantly change the way you interface work the best you can with your client.
Bob Tirola?
On this question, it's hard for me to envision the auditing issues around verifying a number under whatever regime the client is using. I think auditors are very skilled at verification and assessment. The question comes to sort of the fairly present question and the true and fair view question of the financial statements when completed. And I want to just point out a current dilemma in that area. Management certifications of financial statements go to fair presentation, period, not in conformity with U.S. GAAP, just period, whereas auditors' opinions go to U.S. GAAP. There's already this dichotomy between the SEC's requirements of management and the profession's requirements of auditors. And I think that the more different reporting standards that exist, the harder that's going to be to reconcile between fairly stated period and fairly stated in conformity with what?
Any other comments on question four? If not, then Brian DeGonnell is going to lead us through the our discussion of the next series of topics.
Thanks, Ray. And our next topic is evaluation of the fair presentation of the financial statements. And in performing an audit in accordance with PCAOB standards, auditors consider whether the financial statements present fairly in all material respects the financial position, results of operations, and cash flows of a company. PCAOB interim standards, specifically AU section 411.04, provide guidance for auditors. The next question for the SAG to consider is the guidance contained in AU section 411.04 sufficient for audits of financial statements in accordance with IFRS? And as a follow-on question, what other amendments or additions to PCAOB standards might the board need to consider if issuers were allowed to prepare IFRS financial statements? And I'll open it up to the SAG for discussion.
I mean, I think that our view is that it is a principles-based. It's fine. It certainly is going to need to be amended should the commission ultimately accept. So when you're defining GAAP, you're going to have to amend it, obviously, with respect to beyond U.S. GAAP. But that the principles are sufficient.
Let me just add a little bit. You could probably look at this question in different ways. It perhaps is a more general question and maybe not just really limited to IFRS, and perhaps more broadly could be applied against what one might call a more principles-based accounting framework. It seems to me that there may be more pressure put on both management, as Bob Tirola mentioned, and auditors in evaluating fair presentation in a more principles-based framework. So I guess I'd ask the question, is that true? Do you agree with that? And secondly, if that is the case, is there is it appropriate or is there a way for auditing standards to help auditors any more than we already do in that particular challenge?
Oh, Galen Hansen.
I promise not to get off point. With that said, go Rockies, you know. So, but
that was out of order.
All right, it was out of order. 411. You know, it seems to me that's addressing the audit report, but operationally, implementation-wise, it seems to me that there's also some ancillary issues that could affect the audit report in the area of loan compliance. When you're dealing with one set of standards that people contemplated years ago when they entered into loan agreements, and then down the road, you've got a new standard, and which one really controls and governs when it comes to whether or not you're in compliance with those standards, and that does have an effect on the audit report.
Ben Coleman.
You know, I also serve on FASAC, and this discussion that, or Tom, what you just raised was discussed with Bob up at FASAC in a very similar kind of way. Because the notion of going to principles-based is going to change the behavior and the culture, what Bob Kippers was just saying. It's a reality, and I think it's a reality we're ultimately going to have to deal with. It's just a matter of when. And I liken it, just for simplicity, to goalposts, right? That, you know, there's this whole discussion about equivalency, things like that. You know, that there are places, whether you go to the right or to the left, where things are both acceptable and preferable given a set of facts and circumstances and the complexity of the world, and you need to be true to those principles. And there needs to be understandability, and there needs to be transparency. Then there's places where you're outside the goalposts. You know, you're just simply too far to the right or too far to the left. And we're going to need to begin to accept and how to help both preparers and auditors understand where those goalposts are and make sure that we're serving investors the way they expect to be served, because it's the reality of where we're going to be.
Jeff Steinhoff.
What you're really talking about is a fairly substantive change. Decades of working under the current regime and people learning by trial and error, by good and bad experiences, and a certain expectation of what represents a quality job and what these terms mean. You're now moving into a different set of waters, so to speak, somewhat uncharted. And I'm not sure whether it's that this guidance isn't sufficient or whether there just needs to be a new set of guidance and tools. You have a major training and educational process here. A lot of these things are difficult to understand under the current environment. And you're going to a different new environment where people do not have the same base of knowledge that's been built up over decades and decades. So to the extent there can be new and additional guidance, tools, things the colleges can use, this may well affect, maybe this is another part of the meeting, but who can be involved with this? Does this make it even harder for a smaller firm to actually, you know, operate in this environment? But you've got a tremendous amount of unknown here. It's very difficult, I think, to look at a certain section and say, is that sufficient? My guess is it probably isn't, or it probably needs to be changed in some way, or there probably needs to be some other guidance. So you have some degree of predictability, and then at the end of the day, when you're inspecting someone, you know what you're inspecting them against, because you're expecting a certain level today. And you're expecting to see things a certain way within, you know, the left and the right, so to speak. You don't have to be right down the center of the goalpost every time. But here you really haven't, you know, we don't have the experience. So my guess would be you'd have to make changes in some of the guidance.
Bob Kippers.
Just a follow-up. I think that one of the challenges, and I just listening to Jeff, who may be right, and wouldn't be the first time, but, you know, some of this is so intangible, though, I'm not sure that you can create a standard that would or need to even change the one we have to really affect it, because it's such a change in skills and culture, and, you know, the people who have lots of experience around this table probably aren't, I know I'm not worried about that world. I could function in it, no problem, but it's how we train and season our young people as they come up, and I know there's questions about education and things that are next, but I really think it's not fundamentally a standards issue so much as a shift and a change in how we behave and how we face off against the market.
Joe Carcella.
Now I'm going to follow up on Vin's point, and you talked about the goalposts. And I guess the concern, Vin, that I think some people would have is, are the goalposts wider on IFRS than they are on the U.S. GAAP? That's really the question. Do we have wider goalposts? And, you know, one of the things, I don't think this is necessarily a PCAOB issue, but, you know, is there more evidence of earnings management when IFRS are used than U.S. GAAP? Is it more likely that analyst forecasts are met or beaten when IFRS are used in U.S. GAAP? Zovana's favorite topic, abnormal accruals. Is there more evidence of earnings management or whatever metric you want to use on the IFRS than under U.S. GAAP? And that may get at the width of the goalpost, which I think is a concern to certainly investors.
Tom Linsmeyer.
This isn't an auditing standards issue, but I think we need to think about this in context of the financial reporting system with the United States. We have, in the United States, the ability to have, even before there's any failure of a company or litigation, three different parties looking at the financial statements and questioning the financial statements of a preparer. The auditor has that job, but then the Division of Corporation Finance, or the SEC, weighs in. And third, the inspections teams, the PCAOB, weigh in. What is going to happen when there's lots of judgment or more judgment within the system? How are we going to behave? Can we change and respect that judgment? And more importantly, what happens when I'm talking about maybe well-intended judgment at this point, that ex post you find out the judgment was not well-intended. What happens to your abilities when you look back in hindsight about the judgments that are permitted and whether they're credible within the system? And if you have both U.S. GAAP and IFRS GAAP, IFRS system, will we get into litigation where you're comparing what the reported net income or numbers were under one method or another to further question the system that's under use problematically? Right now, with 20 Fs, there are great variations in net income. Jack Sieselski, the accounting observer, has done a very good job sort of summarizing that. Right now, in terms of IFRS, sometimes U.S. GAAP gives you larger net income, but most of the times it's IFRS giving you larger net income. And the numbers are around 25% in terms of mean and median. That's not an insignificant difference. But as we're looking at this as we go forward, I think it's not an auditing standard issue, but how are we as a system going to deal with the second-guessing ex ante and then second-guessing ex post, and what is it going to do in litigation?
Arnie Hanisch.
I guess where I come from on this is wherever these goalposts. I mean, first of all, this I'm not sure that the statement AU 41104 needs to be modified, but I think the goalposts, as Vin refers to them, really will be defined by the company, at least in my view, and it'll be documented. You have principle. We have principles today that we have to deal with, and we document them. We disclose them. To me, the key is the consistent application of those principles. And what you don't want are companies looking at those goalposts and modifying their principles within the goalposts.
And I think that's the key. And from an auditing standpoint, what you want to be able to do is make sure that whatever definition of principal, or however you define the principal, that it is consistently applied year in and year after, year in and year out, to the same kinds of transactions and activities. So there isn't that opportunity. And I think that, to me, that's the key. It's making sure the companies have it documented well enough and disclosed, and that the auditors validate the fact that we're consistently applying these principles. And then you shouldn't have the concerns and the worries.
David Becker.
I actually think there is an auditing concern embedded in this. Whatever the difference between principles and rules means, and I'm frankly not sure that it has a great deal of meaning, it suggests at least that the controlling rules are going to be more general, or are more general than they are now. And to use the goalpost analogy again, we've got three problems. Are the goalposts narrower? Do they move? And are they visible? And without a principle of deference, an attempt to rely more on people's judgment is going to fail. The question is, whose judgment is conclusive and whose judgment is being expressed? So without the confidence, for example, that within some range that their judgment as to accounting issues will be conclusive, issuers and auditors are going to press for more guidance, or they're going to take principle-based guidance as if it were a rules-based. And you know, we've all had experience with that. So that when you talk about fair presentation, you can't really uncouple that from questions of whose view and whose view is conclusive.
Ted White.
Thank you. I just want to step back a little bit. I thought Joe's comments right before we went to lunch were just outstanding, and I would really struggle to add to that. I thought it was just an excellent summary of some of the issues here. And there, you know, from an investor standpoint, there's a number of reasons why I don't like what's coming. But frankly, I'm not sure what that has to do with you, except you have to deal with it. So I guess to move it to action, what are the things that, from an investor standpoint, we would want you to consider doing in preparation? And I suppose that maybe getting the jump on guidance, whether something's going to happen now or whether it's going to be much longer down the road, still going to happen. And that maybe getting a start on, you know, some fairly specific guidance, and it sounds like there's an awful lot of work to do there. But also, how should this affect risk assessment? And it seems to me like, I mean, that's a very integral thing that we talk about at most SAG meetings, that we have a lot of work to do in the coming years on it, and this probably impacts that. But maybe also the inspection process, and so maybe there's a three-prong approach to what, you know, what do you have to do with this? And the last just comment is I'm sort of struck by the link between what we're talking about now and our first topic of the day, which was, you know, your resources and the list of items we need to deal with. It just seems to be a very good example here of what happens to the PCAOB is from externalities that you can't control are probably going to have a fairly significant impact on your ability to be successful with that list. And I don't know what to do about it, obviously, but seems, you know, some flexibility in your willingness and ability to deal with these things has to be built into your budget.
David Julian.
As Chief Accounting Officer, I heard a lot from our lines of business questioning whether I was holding our lines of business to a stricter standard than their peers out in other organizations. whether our accounting firm was holding us to stricter interpretation, and that all in a relatively rules-based environment. Moving to a judgment-based, my fear is that the pressure or the concern is how will we ensure the firms have consistency not only within their own firm, but also across firms, because, again, as a practitioner, when we're sitting there with the lines of business trying to interpret certain decisions and the flexibility they have in applying the accounting rules, they're looking at what are their peers being held to and what are other lines of business being held to. And so it's going to be continue to be a challenge moving into a judgment-based environment and a concern. And my concern is that because of that, firms will start creating their own rules as to how to apply judgment, and pretty soon you're moving into a rules-based environment, but the rules didn't have the opportunity of an open forum to be created, and so certainly concerned there.
Dick Dietrich.
Again, I feel just a little bit like a foreigner, although I understand they play football at Ohio State. So I'm thinking I ought to get this goalpost idea down a little bit better and make sure that I understand what we're really talking about. And I think one way that I look at it is, are there differences in the widths? And how can that be changed if we start looking at IFRS? If there are differences in the width of the goalpost under IFRS, if more things would be deemed acceptable under the accounting principles generally, what's the auditor's responsibility? Is the auditor's responsibility, when we look at this and say, presents fairly, that is, we'll take a wider goalpost, and if it's a wider goalpost, therefore we can give a broad, we can give an opinion that it presents fairly as long as it's anywhere inside the goalposts, regardless of what we personally think as the auditors. Or if we've been watching, for example, using this analogy again, that the kicker consistently puts the ball on the right-hand side of the just in the right-hand goalpost, and the ball's consistently going there, quarter after quarter, and then we see the ball way over on the left side, still inside the goalpost. What does the auditor do then? Does the auditor say, "Wait a minute, it's not consistently applied"? Or it is consistently applied because it's in the goalpost. And so you go ask management, you say, or the kicker, why is the ball over on the left this time? And he says, I thought there was going to be a wind that was going to drive it over, so I pushed the ball, and that's the way it ends up. There's, where do you get the judgment guidance on how to make this determination as the auditor? Now, on one hand, the words that I see here are the words that we worked with for a long time. We seem to be able to work within those words. But I see instances in which we do question the words now. I'm not sure whether more guidance will help us, but I am sure that in a world where we're looking at potentially different widths of goalposts, that these issues will arise. And if we're not prepared for them, they'll arise in ways that I think all of us will feel uncomfortable later.
Damon Silvers.
I want to make a more general comment about the range of issues raised by the possibility of IFRS filers in our markets. I am less, some of whom as a surprise to some, I'm less sort of opposed in principle to the idea that there would be a single global accounting regime than some may be. It strikes me that we increasingly have single, sort of unified markets in many respects, and since we have those, having unified financial reporting arrangements probably is a good idea and probably is in investors' interest. However, I'm concerned in listening to this discussion, and the AFL-CIO does not have an opinion on the question of the SEC's proposed rule at this time, and I've been trying to learn about it and what its implications might be. Struck by several things here. One is the relative lack of, I think the documents the staff prepared are very helpful, but the relative lack of understanding of market participants in the United States of what these differences are and what the potential entrant into our markets of IFRS filers would mean The reluctance of the U.S.-based corporate community to engage in a move away from GAAP generally that I perceive, I may be wrong about that, and the feeling that I have in listening to these discussions that we may, for good reasons, I don't fault the Commission in this respect, that we may be moving in this direction prematurely, that convergence is probably a better idea than choice, and that we need to have a strategy in relationship to our regulators for how to get the right kind of convergence, and that choice may take away our leverage in that process. These are very tentative conclusions I'm coming to, and we have an open mind. I personally and my employer institutionally have an open mind about this. But I think that just in listening to this discussion, that it feels like in many different ways we're just not quite ready for this. And the thing I'm most struck by is that we have these very substantial areas of great discretion that the staff outlined here, which then the question comes, okay, what's in the minds of the PCAOB or ultimately in the minds of the courts, you know, what constitutes a fair presentation of financial statements in this context? And if no one knows the answer, is it necessarily good for us in terms of the way we want to treat foreign private issuers to expose them to that? So I sound a note of caution. I'm willing to be persuaded that I shouldn't worry, but I'm a little concerned now.
Lynn Turner.
I don't think it matters what title you put on the accounting standards, where you put IASB at the top or FASB at the top. What matters is whether whatever you end up with, it gives investors the information they need in a very timely and complete fashion to be able to make an informed decision so the markets do stay efficient. So I think that's where you have to start with the guiding light. When you think back about the problems that we've had in the markets right up to the current time period, even as we all sit here with the subprime mess, I step back and I say, clearly we've had some problems with the U.S. standards and with some of the debacles that we have there. If I was someone resident in London, I'd probably be saying, why would I put my money in the U.S. markets? Because the standards over there really haven't given me protection. In fact, we saw record amounts of cash outflows out of the U.S. markets by foreign investors in August. And it's not the first time it's happened. It happened with the Enrons and all. So realistically, I understand why people overseas come in and say the risk in the U.S. capital markets is appears to be quite significant anymore to investors. Every time they turn around, they're losing money over here, watching television as their depositors take a run on North Rock. And so you have to ask, are our standards really good or that good? Likewise, though, the international standards have certainly fallen short. And you look at the protections in places like Japan, which I mentioned earlier, where they actually had to shut down a firm because the audits were so bad and fraud was involved within the audit firm. So to me, neither one has demonstrated their ability to get investors, quite frankly, what they need. So I've been of the opinion for quite some period of time that you keep the reconciliation in place because it's the hammer you use and the oversight tool you use, the carrot, if you will, to force the FASB and force the ISB to keep improving the standards to get them to where they need to be. And neither one's perfect, and both have a long ways to go, but if you lose that hook with the reconciliation, you will never, ever get there. And so that's been my concern from that perspective. With respect to the question that you have up on the screen and what I've heard about goalposts and these days where I'm coming from, where we're
21 out of 22. We're swinging for the ballpark, and the Rockies are looking really good. So we're not talking about goalposts where I'm from, or Galen, you know, home of the future World Series champions. It'll probably take us 4 or 5 games to put that one away. But with respect to 411, I actually probably would make a change or an addition. And the SEC has long had a rule, a principle, whatever you want to call it, because I agree there's not any real difference between either one. SEC views their compensation disclosure document, 450 pages, is a principle. That's what they keep telling us. I'm not sure I'd call that a principle, and I hope we aren't head down that direction with the principles. But I would the SEC does have this thing on their books that says, is kind of a catch-all that says, if there's material information that isn't caught up by some other rule, principle, or whatever, you still can't get out from underneath it just because there's not a rule on the books. And I don't think there's any way FASB or ISB can ever write something for everything. So when you start looking at 411.04, which originally was drafted coming out of the Continental Vending case, I would turn around and tell you that what we need to get into that is language. Not only have you made sure that these things are in accordance with GAAP and got all, you know, the required disclosures, but furthermore, let's add the language that the SEC has on their books in both the 33 and 34 Act that says, and as a catch-all, if there's other material information out there that's material to the financial statements and the reader of those financial statements, but it's not required by a specific rule, it needs to turn around and be disclosed. And that's about as principle-based a notion as you can get. So it also helps with this issue of goalpost, if you will, for both U.S. and international standards, because they both got these shortcomings, but that allows both the regulator as well as the auditors to say, hey, yeah, it may not be there in the book, but we need to get it in there. And so I'd certainly encourage you to make that modification to 411.
Thanks. So just as a side note, we do have something similar, at least along those lines. I believe it's an AU 431. I can't quote it to you, but we certainly will take a look at that. Thanks.
I would say after the Citigroup SIVs, not a whole lot of people are paying attention to it, if you do have it, because there's a lot of material information in the SIVs and a number of these institutions that was never disclosed and clearly material.
Galen Hansen.
Since we're talking about goalposts, I thought maybe I could mention something about a level playing field when we're talking about reconciliation. You know, over the course of my career, it used to be that we would go out and do the audit, and we're out there for some period of time, but usually it happened once a year. And as time has gone by, we're involved in these quarterly reviews. And for the larger engagements, people are virtually in the field, I mean, a good part of the year, and they're significantly involved with these issuers. And the point that I wanted to make is in the foreign side of this, where they the counterpart to a Form 10-K is a Form 20-F. And that form, they're given, first of all, they're given 6 months, as I understand, to be able to file that. That would seem to have to be addressed, and it's probably more of an SEC issue. But also just the aspect of, from an auditing standpoint, being in the field, being involved with that client, and really knowing what's going on with them. I can tell you that in our firm, anyway, we do a lot of the auditing procedures on a quarterly basis, particularly in the area of equity and so forth. And it would seem to me that the foreign private issuers would have to have the same reporting standards as what our domestic issuers are. Right now, not all countries have interim reporting, so you don't have foreign private issuers that are necessarily issuing on a – I don't think they issue – very many of them issue on a quarterly basis at all. Some of them issue semi-annual interim, and then their year-end. So I think that might be something to consider. I'm not sure that it fit exactly into the question, but I think it does speak to auditing.
Kimberly Gabelitz.
Just reflecting on this topic that we've been discussing for a couple of hours now, I'm a little surprised by the surprise. I felt like when I entered into the auditing side of the world, albeit from the internal auditing side of the world, in the 1999 timeframe, that we were on a path to convergence across the globe. We'd started the global accounting standards. I kind of entered into that, the rules versus the principles base, started having those debates, and really just saw people starting to work together. And with the advent of Enron and other activities, not only in the U.S. but around the world, I felt like we all kind of retrenched, tried to polish and make our own systems better. And I think we're just kind of emerging from that and getting back to the agenda and the convergence path I felt we were already on. So I'm a little struck by, I guess for some it may be new to them to be into it, but I really felt like we've been thinking about this for some time. And I think the progress and the data we're going to look at later from the research kind of shows we are making things better. We're on an evolutionary path. If there were bright lines, I think the smart people that are around this table and around the globe would have already defined them. Doesn't mean we shouldn't start keep looking for them to drive the variance out of it. But I think the reality is today, under a more rules-based, as we call it, world, there's a lot of judgment that still has to be applied. And I think the thing we deal with in this room each time is that the risk-based side of things, the judgment side of things, people are uncomfortable with that, and it is much easier to do a little equation and make it come out right. But I know from the operations side and in dealing with our auditors, we're constantly testing those judgments together under a rules-based approach, if you would say that's the U.S. approach. I don't see that changing or the aperture getting wider for myself and an international, and I would be interested in the accounting firm's view if they feel like there's a wider view on what would be acceptable outside of the U.S. boundaries from an IFRS standpoint. But I see it's just that constant engagement, and as long as you have a way, a governance structure, and an authoritative body to which, say, the SEC, that these eventually have to get filed into, those things are going to come together. And if the auditor and the company they're auditing don't agree, you know, that's how the opinion comes out. There are definite checks and balances. There isn't just a agree to disagree and then it just gets hidden. The transparency is key in all of this. And I think one of the transparency things and the working together things I'd encourage us to do is do like you've started here, list the differences and the changes. And let's just hammer them through. I'm not sure that bright lines exist on a lot of these things. That's why we keep looking at fair value. I mean, I applaud us and keep looking at it and keep looking at it, and there might be something that changes. But these are old issues that if, you know, they had a really easy answer, we might have already come to them. So don't give up the fight. Keep pushing forward. But we got to keep going on the journey. This is a global world. It's a global economy. Whether we go to anything of this nature or not, I believe the firms are already having to deal with this. So the firms that you're auditing already have are in this world, whether anybody else adopts it or not. Thanks.
Well, let's now turn to the topic of auditor education. PCAOB standards require an audit to be performed by persons having adequate technical training and proficiency. Colleges and universities design accounting programs for students to pass the CPA exam, which is based on U.S. GAAP. Moreover, auditing firms need to take the lead in training their staff in auditing financial statements prepared in IFRS. This would bring us to the next series of questions for the SAG. And the first question is, what steps would colleges and universities need to take to train new graduates to audit financial statements of issuers prepared in accordance with IFRS? And there's two follow-on questions. First, what is the timeline to complete the task likely to be, and the second, what changes in the CPA exam, if any, might be required. Now I'll turn it over to the SAG for discussion. Joe Carcella.
There's a couple of implicit assumptions in your question. One implicit assumption is that all universities and colleges that offer accounting programs will even want or agree to do this. A number of them may decide that they're better served training people for careers in managerial accounting, internal auditing, private company work, because the cost of gearing up to do this for colleges and universities is quite significant. And contrary to what a lot of people in this room may believe, most colleges and universities, really all of them, even the private ones, they're not profit-making enterprises. So they may say, hey, there's not a whole lot in this for us. We'll just serve a different market segment. And unless there's a surplus of people trained in the skill set, which every recruiter I talk to at firms like Vins and Bob's and Sam's, there seems to be a shortage, think very carefully about unintended consequences. So that's one issue. The other issue is unless the CPA exam is changed, you put faculty in a really very, very uncomfortable position, because students and their parents and taxpayers and a lot of people who are our constituents expect our graduates to pass the CPA exam. And if the CPA exam is still going to test FASB standards and SASs, and we're going to be training them on IFRS and PCAOB standards and maybe ISA's international standards on auditing, there's a real disconnect between the licensing exam and what we're teaching them in school. And I don't know how that will play out. I really don't.
Dick Dietrich.
I want to reinforce some of the things that Joe just said. Right now, students take a set number of hours. If we put something in, something else comes out. So the question is, we want to teach them IFRS, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for us to consider doing. What do we not teach them? And so we have to think about that. Or are we going to ask them to be in school for a longer period of time, to take additionally, essentially one more course or two more courses? Lynn Turner earlier today spoke to the issue of the need for curriculum materials. Now, faculty members can be very creative in developing their own materials, but if you want to have widespread adoption, it really does help to have content that other people can pick up. Third, to the extent that there are a large number of people who would be the educators who are not now familiar with IFRS, we have a problem of training the faculty in the area as well. Fourth, we've talked to recruiters or students at Ohio State about the need for putting in a course in international financial reporting standards. 2 years ago, the answer generally was no, we don't need that. It's not very important for the kinds of clients that we have in the regions where our students generally work. And so we think about doing that again today. The question is, who are the clients that would actually need to have students who do that? If what we're talking about is a small sample of the total number of employees that are hired every year, and I believe the number roughly is 10 to 15,000 people a year going to work for the major public accounting firms. So you look at that and say, what percentage of those students would actually be in positions where IFRS education would benefit them? You get back to the next point that Joe raised, which is when they look at that against what they need to do for the other potential career opportunities they have, the need to prepare for the CPA examination, how will they make that evaluation themselves? And so there'll be a challenge that I think is especially significant if it's not included in the CPA exam, as Joe has identified. There'll be a different challenge if it is included in the CPA exam, because now we'll have a large number of students who are going to have to learn a body of knowledge that they will not use in their professional careers with great likelihood. So how will that work? Should that be done at the university, or should that be done in some other forum? For example, public accounting firms have very significant continuing professional education series. Is it something that would be better served by having them take on this responsibility? But if they do it after certification, then what role does the certification process play? Those are all of the issues that I think are raised here when one thinks about that. And we've had discussions previously about fair value and the extent to which we have to do fair value. I think someone else this morning gave a very nice litany of all the things that are sort of new topics. for how we do that. The other part of that that I think we should be careful about is when we think about certification requirements, we have to recognize that content will change over time. Faculties right now are willing to engage in content change. One of the things that holds us back is what's currently on the CPA examination. Students know that. And so when we say we have some interesting new content that we think will help you in your professional career, their response quite often is, if it's not on the CPA exam, I don't care. So we have to be careful about what's really driving the students here and the incentives that they face.
Galen Hansen.
I wanted to follow up with both Joe and Richard's comments because I think it dovetails exactly into the CPA exam and just kind of give you a little synopsis of how that works. There's basically a two-year lag. And as they were saying, I mean, it's not fair to students to test them on something that they haven't been taught in school. That just isn't going to work. But this two-year lag, we're currently going through, the Board of Examiners is going through an analysis, and they go through that exam, and there's psychometrics involved in this thing, QCing the examination. But there is about a two-year lag. So if we were to adopt it, the first time we would be able to start testing on IFRS would probably be sometime in 2009. So realistically, with the having to give students an opportunity to be educated in these standards, you're looking sometime well after that because it's going to take them some period of time to be educated. Not to, to throw water on the thing, but realistically, that's what you're looking at on the exam.
Okay.